Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. This is the final stream of tonight, the fourth stream of the fourth night, and I'm here with Dangerfield. I'm sure you all know Dangerfield from YouTube, and welcome.
An absolute pleasure. The graveyard shift. Yes. The last one of the day.
Yeah, well, it was the one. It usually goes to an American, you know, or someone in Canada or America, because that's their. I don't know what time it is there just now, but usually. But in your case, you're in a different part of the world. So anyway, it's
Can I ask? Was it tactical? Did you think I'm going to be shattered by the fourth or fifth one? Let's get Dangerfield on because it's low IQ banter, dare I say.
You know that's not the case. You chose the dance slot. I would have been happy to have you on earlier. But no, I wouldn't do that. Although I do try to have the heavier ones on earlier so that I'm not, exhausted. And yeah, the first two tonight were pretty damn heavy. What can you do? I hope I performed okay. So but anyway, it's nice to have you back on.
I've said this to you every year. I don't know how you do it. I stream twice daily with no one, just me, and that it just shatters me. Now I know I've got a few years on you, but good Lord, where'd you get the energy from? I can see us in like 2028 and halfway through millennial, you're just going to go, no more, and then just sort of boom. I can't do it again. But thank you for asking me. I think this is my third or fourth, and of course, once you've done, I think two every year, it's like, am I going to get asked? And if not, why?
See, that's the thing. I always feel bad about this because some people, like this year, there were some people I couldn't have on that I would like to have had on. But there are going to be 64 streams. So I have to leave some people out. And it's annoying, but, there's only so much I can do. On the thing about streaming, when you're streaming on your own, that's actually more tiring because you've got to do all the thinking and all the talking. So
I disagree. I find that maybe it's my narcissism, but if I've got someone else on, I've got to engage with what they're saying. I can barely keep up with what I'm saying. So when there's someone else on and I've actually got to listen to them, that really tires me out. Really, I see it the other way, definitely.
Right, okay. Well, with Millennial, I mean, you get into a routine and it's four a night. And if each one is fairly short, and I'm not doing well this year at keeping them short, but if they are fairly short, then you get a break in between each one of like half an hour to recharge. Sure. So, I'm going to have to get better. I'm going to have to be more ruthless with people and say, okay, like, let's just hurry this up now.
Egg timer at the start. Yeah.
This is what you've got, buddy. But that's the thing. It would lead to better quality content because it's more concise. So I probably should do that.
You're doing well though on Odyssey though. I just as I got over it, you're over 4,000 followers on Odyssey. Amazing.
Yeah, it's gone up. I think it's 4,500 or something. I don't know how many viewers we're getting actually. I'll have to have a look at that.
Yeah, not now. Not during this stream, please. I don't need those numbers.
No, there are quite a few people watching, so don't worry about that. But hold on a second. Let me just see the other one because I've inadvertently, as we were discussing this before we went on air, I wasn't quite sure about how Odyssey works, and I accidentally gave out a generic URL, millennial/live, but each stream also has its own URL. And that leads to some confusion because then you've got two different live chats. It's the same video that's being watched, but you've got two separate live chats. So if you are watching on /live, I'll tell you where to go. I'll tell you exactly where to go to find the real video. And that is here. Let's paste it in. There we go. So That would be good. And that is actually why there's been a fuck up with me missing some of the super chats. I think it's because people have been posting them in that one and nobody's been monitoring that thread. So my apologies for doing that. It was I wasn't sure how Odyssey does live streaming, and it is a bit different. It's quite a bit different from YouTube. So teething troubles. My apologies. Anyway, with all of that said, Chris Dangerfield, welcome back, and what are your thoughts on the year 2021? It hasn't been quite as much of a fucking, well, head fuck as 2020 was. I mean, that had COVID, BLM, and the US election. So, I mean,
I'm not so sure, actually. This 2021 for me has been about the communist administration running the USA. That's massive. For the first time in my adult life, I'm witnessing a very weak America and the implications of that with China, with the neo-Soviet Union.
And Afghanistan, of course.
Yeah, and that for me has been the big thing of this year. They've done so much damage in such a short space of time, and the transparency of it that seems to come up on my streams regularly. It's almost as if they know that these people hate the United States of America. They want to destroy it. That's all they want to do, whilst, you know, filling their pockets, obviously. They're not, you know, they were energy independent. They were trading energy, and now they're begging OPEC to make more oil. And that alone is absurd. You know, I just think that's mind blowing. And then you've got the southern border. Then you've got the high inflation. Then you've got all the other stuff that's going on. And you know, this sort of this farcical verging on the surreal. President Biden's just it's what the fuck is going on there? It's you know, Reagan's second term, he was a little bit dodgy and it was a little bit funny, but this bloke is there's a great documentary. He's a bit of a leftist, but Adam Curtis made a documentary called Bitter Lake, and it's interestingly set around how Afghanistan has changed over the last sort of five decades. But the main sort of theme of the documentary is that in the information era, we're kind of being hypnotized. You'd think if you've got access to more information, you'd be cleverer, more well-informed, whatever. Whereas actually you're in a sort of a state of, you know, you're sort of zombified. There's quite a nice, relationship to ADHD treatment. I always thought that they treated kids with ADHD with Ritalin or any stimulant because it was the old treat like with like. But I've got a friend and he's worked in that field, and he says, oh no, it's far worse than that. What actually happens is they give kids, I mean, I don't believe in ADHD anyway. I don't think it's a hyperactive attention deficit disorder. They're just deficit of attention. Now, weirdly, when it's been pathologized, weirdly, when it's like, oh, you've got this, then you have to see a key worker, then you have to see a doctor, then your parents give you more time, and suddenly you're getting the attention that children need. And so you're cured. That's the actual treatment, but at the end of it, they're selling you tablets. But what they actually do is give the kids more stimulation so that the brain shuts down. And so then they just sort of close down. The brain says, no, I can't handle all this stimulation. And the shutters come down. And I think that's kind of what's happened with the USA, you know, over the last year. It's just so crazy. There's so much blatant and transparent dodgy dealings going on that people just can't process it.
Yeah, it's completely corrupt. I mean, the US election last year was obviously rigged, obviously defrauded. And I don't say that as a massive Trump fan. You know, by the end of it, it was yeah, not the most exciting president. not someone to get very excited about, let's put it that way. But still, it was a symbolic thing. It was, you know, represented something. And I think that's why they got rid of him, mostly. Because as I was just saying to my previous guest, if he had got in, nothing would really be very different. We'd still have had the stuff this year that happened.
I don't know about that.
You go for it, yeah.
I challenge that because I hear a lot of people saying, oh, what's the saying? Dog and pony show, you know, there's no political solution. But people's lives in America under the current communist administration is very different to what it was under Trump, you know, significantly different. Just the weakness of that nation at the moment. You know, we live in a hierarchical planet. Someone's got to be at the top. And I'd rather it be America than China. I'd rather it be America than the new Soviet Union they're trying to build, because that puts us all at incredible risk. And America will then become the target. You know, after the Cold War, and I think it's kind of weird to say after because it never really ended, but they played out their battles in like Vietnam and Nicaragua or wherever. But this will, if this carries on for, I don't know, maybe even in the time of this administration, that could come home. That could come home to America. And if superpowers like China and America are actually at war,
you see,
that's very frightening.
You're just old enough to remember the Cold War properly. I mean, I vaguely remember it.
Sorry, yeah, no teenagers slept in the 80s. It was terrifying.
Good. Can you remember Threads being shown on TV?
Yep. Threads was, you know, at school the next day, there were kids still crying. I mean, I know it sounds like a millennial kind of thing, but people were traumatized from Threads. For people who don't know, Threads was I think it was an ITV movie made for telly about what happened in Sheffield if there was a nuclear strike on England.
It was 1984, and it was really well made and very well regarded.
Yeah, but around that time, everything was consumed by a nuclear war. The pop music, you know, 99 Red Balloons was about a nuclear attack. Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Enola Gay, which was the name of the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, I think, or Nagasaki, one of the two. You know, there's five or six of those songs. There was the leaflet that came through your door, Protect and Survive, that was in conjunction with the...
And of course, another... yeah, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Two Tribes was all about that as well.
Yeah, loads of it. But that Protect and Survive, they were... the Raymond Briggs thing. When the Wind Blows.
Oh, yes. I haven't seen that, but I've heard about it. I've heard it's really upsetting.
Yeah, and it was for children. This was a bloke that done Fungus the Bogeyman the year before, and it was like, oh, Fungus the Bogeyman, hilarious. Oh, what's this new one? Ah, all their heads falling out, put it down. But, you know, Protect and Survive was literally, when you hear the sound, you know, the intro to Two Tribes, when you hear the alarm, when you hear the sound, the old air raid siren in Protect and Survive, I think that's what it was called. It might be slightly different to that. You know, paint your doors white, put them up against the wall at 45 degrees, put all your clothes in suitcases and pile them up on it, get some water in there, and you and your family, and you're watching this as like in 1982, which I suppose was at the height of it, I was about 10. And this is imminent as far as you're concerned. You know, if they're telling you prepare to make a little a little nuclear bunker in your front room,
it's funny you say that, because I can remember 8 years, whenever the Gulf War started, I think that was 91. Let me just find out. But I can remember that being on TV. 91, yeah, just into 91. And I remember watching that being announced on TV, we are now at war. And as a child, you think, oh my God, it's, that means like World War II, that big one when people were, the bombs were landing on cities and all that. And so you think that's what it's going to be. But of course, the threat of nuclear war 9 years earlier that you're talking about is even more serious than that. It's a nuclear war, nuclear bombs being detonated in your city, which would be obviously unimaginable.
We had a thing at school where in science, this is mad to remember, and the teacher on the blackboard, he'd done like five circles, and we were, as the crow flies, about 40 miles out the centre of London. So not that they would bomb Parliament, I think they'd be bombing communications and you know, energy, whatever. But if they targeted Parliament, in this circle, you're dying the blast. This is what the teacher was telling us. In this circle, something else. And in our circle, our skin will be burnt off in hot winds. And we're 11, just going, good, that's good. And you rack that up with all the music, threads. And there was, you know, there was many more versions of different sort of takes like threads. No, terrifying times. And I got over that trauma, and just at the end of it's weird because this is all in my novel, Shill Early. This is all in my forthcoming novel, but just when we matured past, all right, maybe this isn't happening, perestroika, glasnost, okay, then it was AIDS. And the AIDS thing compared to the coup is, sorry, I'm a YouTuber, I don't know if I can actually say the, well, I don't know if I have to
yes,
say
you COVID. You can say COVID, yeah.
Freedom. you know, AIDS to the tip of the iceberg. You know, we had Ian Dury on prime time, 6 p.m. news, showing how to put a condom on this model of an erect penis. And, you know, and then in the adverts between the news, it was that iceberg. Dun, real dark drone music, and it'll be just this little iceberg. By 2015, everyone will know someone who's died of the AIDS. You all dying, don't fuck anyone, you bastards. This is just the tip of the iceberg. And that was much like another, that was like a cultural Cold War. You know, there's this thing looming. And so, you know, and I remember my dad saying to me, because when the AIDS thing came about, I was about 14, and, you know, kids at my school were fucking, and I realised that that was soon going to be on the cards for me. And he said to me, he said, I just feel sorry for your generation, he said, because, A, this is a lie, which was a lovely thing for him to say, because that, you know, I trusted my dad. He said, A, this is a lie, he said, and B, I wonder what their motivations are.
So why did he think it was a lie? That,
well, I went back to him about that, because when he actually said that, it was the start of it all, but it went on, and then we got the leaflets, like it was the AIDS version of Protect and Survive. I think I've got that right. I can't see the chat, so if someone keeps saying it's not Protect and Survive, but whatever.
No, it is. I looked it
okay.
up.
Yes. It went on, and I said to him, why is this a lie? And he said, because I've seen it all before. We had this with VD in the 70s. And so venereal disease in the 70s was treated much like that. You know, you're going to get sick, and it can be really bad. And, you know, just another moral panic, or, you know, so these things come around. Yeah.
Was that venereal disease? Oh, it is actually a specific disease. I thought that was a generic name for just what we now call STDs.
No, it's quite a bad thing, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Get it. Condoms don't protect. Oh, no, I've my programming is coming out. No, you got to watch out for it.
Yeah, I didn't know it was actually a specific thing.
But what an upbringing, though. You know, age 10 to 20 was the Cold War and AIDS. And it really was dominated by that. Which is, you know, I think there is something to say about the fact that at the end of the 80s, you know, because all alongside all of that, you've got the sort of Thatcherite, you know, don't get married, don't have a family, go out there, enjoy yourself, make loads of money. The biggest comedian, Harry Enfield, his joke was that he had loads of money. That was it. You know, his punchline was loads of money. And the audience would be cracking up, oh, look, he's got loads of money. He's a working class bloke and he's got loads of money. And that was it. That was a joke. And the reason people laughed at that, I think, was because there was loads, you know, it was the nouveau riche, you know. Early 80s, you go around your mate's house and it's cheese balls and pineapple and cheddar on a cocktail stick. And by the end of the 80s, they were trying to put stuff that they'd seen on the cover of The Observer in front of you. You'd be like, what the fuck is this? Half a pilchard on a triangle of bread. Where's my cheese balls? But I think the whole ecstasy thing and what they then called the second summer of love was a youth cultural response to a very traumatic, unpleasant, and largely unnecessary cultural experience of growing up in the 80s. You know, I hated ecstasy. I mean, most people watching this will know my life has been riddled with addiction. But there was, you know, the backlash to the Cold War and AIDS and Lord knows what else was a drug that made you think you loved everyone. I mean, that doesn't come as a surprise to me. I think there's a sort of certain historical materialist link to these things. Like cocaine was around for 100 years before people freebased it and made it crack. And you know, crack lasts for 5 minutes, if that, 3 minutes. And that came around at the same time as our culture became more disposable. So I think there's a similar link to ecstasy coming at the end of the 80s. I don't think ecstasy would have taken off in like the 70s, for instance, because the sort of cultural consciousness wouldn't have needed it. And, you know.
Yeah, and you can understand why psychedelics were big in the late 60s and early 70s, because it links with, I mean, it was the perfect drug for the hippies. It was the perfect drug for people who were rebelling against all previous, you know, conventions and traditional society and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't actually thought about that at length, but that does make sense. I think you'll see that all the way actually with anything that will change the way you think and the way you feel. There'll be a cultural link there, because why wouldn't there be? You know, why else would people take to something like that? You know, the best place to see that change for me was the terraces. You got this working class audience to football, well, working class participants at the time, and a lot of fighting, a lot of violence. You know, when you've got the Cold War and AIDS in the background, you're quite happy to go out on a Saturday and drink 10 pints and kick the shit out of anyone. You know, I remember seeing firms ending up kicking the shit out of each other if the other firm didn't turn up, just because they needed to fight and be hit. And then ecstasy took over the terraces, and in like a weekend, football violence in England finished. Really weird.
I guess that links with this thing about, you know, weed, marijuana being preferable to alcohol because it doesn't make people violent. I mean, I've heard people say, you know, that they should just legalize marijuana because it would be better than people getting drunk and, you know, getting into fights. So what would you say about that?
Well, it's funny, actually. I've been talking about this recently. I was a stay high for, you know, my late teens, most of my 20s, until I got into heroin. And, you know, you're not going to waste money on weed when you've got to buy heroin. But when I was smoking weed in the 80s, they were non-selectively bred land race strains, Durban Poison, Afghani number one. There was solid hashish, like blonde Lebanese, Red Seal. These were just nature's products, essentially. Charis has been around for millennia. And Prohibition created what we now know as hybrid weed, because you want to pack more THC, the active ingredient, into it. But in the late 60s, the hippies were smoking weed that was probably, you know, between about 4 and 6%. 6% THC would be a really good bit. But you'd be able to smoke a couple of joints and then leave your house without being terrified. But the selectively bred whole hydroponics revolution, you know, the weed today is like 25, 30% THC. It's a different drug.
It's fucking powerful. I mean, yeah.
And that's caused problems.
Not sure what to say here, but it's more powerful than I can remember it being 20 years ago, even when you could have a joint and you'd still be fairly normal. You know, now a few drags and, you know.
I hadn't smoked any weed for a few years, and I for people who don't know, I live in Cambodia, and I grew a load out here. It's a perfect climate for outdoors. I grew a load, I cured it. You know, I'd done a lot of growing in the past, so I knew what I was doing. I made one joint up. I had about three drags on it, and I got into bed and just thought, please let this stop. I need to sleep. This is horrible. And there's a real problem there, because the culture of cannabis has remained the same, and the thinking about it has remained the same since the late 60s. Yet the drug has changed.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. And there are people who smoke it every day. As if it is still the stuff of 50 years ago. I mean, I, you know, just to be clear, I just don't want to give people any incorrect ideas. I'll have a drag maybe once a year, right? And that's seriously.
This is Woz's I didn't inhale moment.
Yeah. It is true. It's true, though, because like, I'll have two or three drags once a year, and it only happens once a year because that's like I would never seek it out, and two or three drags is all I need, and I'm fucking stoned. And it's like this is just fine. It's not something that I have much interest in, because, you know, I don't know, I'm not in my 20s anymore. You know, you start to think, I just don't need this. I'm just not interested.
Yeah. But I, you know, again, there was a big group of us in the 80s. We'd all get together. You'd be giggling your head off. You'd end up at the 24-hour petrol station to buy a lot of GAC, Marses, and chocolate milkshakes. But now I see that, well, not out here, actually, strangely, because you can get hybrid weed out here. You can just buy it in shops. You can smoke it anywhere as well. But weirdly, because of that, most people smoke just the stuff that we were smoking in the 80s. But I've been to, I've lost count, but it's probably more than 20 rehabs for heroin. And when I first started my rehab career, there'd be people in there for cannabis. And I'd sort of pull rank. I'd be like, what, you're in rehab for weed? Are you joking? This is ridiculous. But after a while, you know, this stuff is ruining people's lives, and especially young people whose brains haven't fully formed. You know, we were smoking weed at 14, 15, and again, like I say, the culture around it hasn't changed, but the drug has. And not only is the THC, I don't want to get too scientific about this because it's dull as fuck, but while the THC has gone up, the CBD has almost disappeared. And so has the attention to terpenes. And so the natural medicinal and full kind of experience has gone, and you're left with just sitting there. There's no creativity. I'm not seeing that from these youngsters. I'm just seeing brain dead zombies. Will my welfare cover my speed, because when I was on welfare, I was on speed. Will my welfare cover my skunk habit? Can I deal a little bit? That'll do me. And yeah, that's it. Yeah. And they jump behind the sofa when the phone rings. You know, it's just shocking.
Yeah, yeah. It switches people off. I mean, this is another reason that I would never want to get into it. And I know it's not like, you know, you smoke one joint and then you're addicted to the demon weed. But still, it clearly does have the capacity to take over people's lives. And you'll certainly know this from, you'll have known loads of people, I'm guessing, at art college who are like this. I certainly knew people who were like this. They're constantly stoned. And they're actually really fucking, I know it sounds such a sort of cliche thing to say, but they're really boring to be around.
No, they're dull as fuck, unless you're stoned. They don't realise that. You know, they think they're the funniest people in the world, and they always want you to smoke weed when you're with them because they need you to do that to be on their wavelength. Otherwise, everything they say doesn't mean anything to you, and they don't like that. And for creatives to use drugs like cannabis, that it's just ridiculous because unless your audience is stoned, they're not going to give a shit. They're just going to be like, well, I don't, you know... Good art, good music, good anything creative, in my experience, comes out of clarity, comes out of investigation. And there are two things you're not getting on something like cannabis. Now, I'm not saying that drugs haven't inspired artists or whatever, but again, not all day, every day. That's just ridiculous. The one famous alcoholic painter just poured it on the canvas on the floor. Jackson Pollock. I mean, okay, nice, but that's been done. So give up on it, drinkers. And I despise that that mythology of the sort of tortured, addicted artist. Because most of the artists, writers, musicians I know that have actually achieved anything, not, you know, there's obviously the odd anomaly. But these are people who've dedicated a lot of time and effort to it. They haven't sat around eating pizzas and smoking weed and having ripping B loaves for breakfast.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are people who think, well, I'll just ruin my life. I'll be on drugs all the time, and I won't have any hope, any direction. And that then I'll be tortured, and then I'll produce good work. But it doesn't really work like that.
No.
Because then you're just a mess. You're not actually, I mean, it's, well, yeah, it's a difficult thing to talk about, I guess. But torture, being a tortured artist comes from wanting something and not getting it. That's why you're tortured. It's not just that you're your life's a mess. You know, anyone can do that. It's not going to be easy to do that.
You can do it without thinking. Yeah, I don't know how we got there, but anyway, yeah, I grew up during the Cold War.
Well, you know, I grew up during the 90s, and I don't know, I remember in the 90s having tremendous curiosity about the 80s and wondering what was it like for kids 10 years ago, who were my age now, 10 years ago. They had different music. And that's the thing. That's an interesting thing in itself, the fact that there was such a stark contrast between the aesthetics and styles in the space of 10 years. Whereas now, you know, it's becoming a sort of cliche point to make at this stage, but it's still a very interesting point because nobody can explain it. Culture has stood still for the last 20 years. Really, since the year 2000,
I think people can explain it. I think Francis Fukuyama explained it in his book, The End of History. You know, the insistence on teaching postmodernism in art schools, I think, kind of explains it. You know, we've reached our geographic and historical limits. We've been all around the globe. We've looked all the way back to history. So all we can do now is look back. And so, you know, I think that to give a great example, when I look back at the very few photographs there are of me and my brother as kids in the 70s, there's a couple of Polaroids. They're authentic Polaroids, which have also faded through time. And they have the aesthetic of not the Polaroids, but the stuff that we used to, you know, when you had to get a film canister and take it to Boots and they'd send you your pictures, you know, the processing, the quality of the printing, the quality of the inks, the quality of the paper, it's all of 1976 or 1982. It has its era stamped all over it. And then when you get to the 2000s, for instance, and filters and Instagram, and you can make it look like this, you can make it look like this, children, millennials have got no aesthetic. So in 20, 30 years, when they look back at their childhood photographs, well, why does your childhood photo look like you grew up in the 70s? Oh, because I put a filter on it. Oh, and then this one. Why does this one? This what? When was this taken? Oh, 1986. Yeah, but it looks like it's from the 40s. Yeah. They have. There's no aesthetic to their own history.
Well, the technology now is so good that it just looks like real life, pretty much. So,
yeah, but they don't opt for that, do they? They don't opt for that. They opt for the filters. They opt for the thing that makes it look. You know, you've got the hyperreal angle, which they look like Jeff Koons' works of art. You know, they've got not a spot, not a blemish. Their face has been symmetrified. I'm going to use that again. You know, or you pick a time and a date. And so they haven't got an authentic history. And I know that will have implications, because that is part of, you know, putting down roots. That's part of ancestry. That's part of who you are. And if who you are has suddenly been muddled, has been conned, you're being tricked, well, who are you? You know, what are you? And you know, I've got a friend who's had implants put in voluntarily so that he can open his door, turn his light on, turn his telly over with a wave of his hand. And you know, this kind of sort of this prosthetic kind of thing we're moving into, add that to it all, the human condition, I think, is I'm fucking glad I'm old. That all I could think of while I was saying all that was I lived in an England that was brilliant. The 70s were amazing. The 80s it started going wrong, and we're now reaping the anti-rewards of the 80s.
So you're funnily enough echoing your father's words when he said, I feel sorry for your generation.
There you go, yeah. So maybe there's no change after all.
No, but you can understand why, though. If there has been a constant decline, then each generation would say that about the next generation. Like, I feel sorry for you guys. You have to deal with all this shit. I mean, you know, I'm really glad that I'm not 18 now, you know, because... Yeah. Fucking hell. The stuff that 18-year-olds have, the stuff that 10-year-olds have to endure now at school, the brainwashing, oh my God, it must be fucking nightmarish.
Would you think about, if I think about that, I left home at 16, I'd done 8 years of higher education, I had a master's degree at 23, it was mainly art schools, so it was a lot of sex, a lot of drugs, a lot of partying, a lot of conversations. You know, they were great days when you'd be in the art school bar arguing about Derrida and with passion, and there'd be a group of 10 of you really, you know, not fighting, but really passionate about, you know, the art, the artistic practice and all that. And having wild times around that. And what are 16 to 23-year-olds doing now? They can't even go out, can they, in England? I don't know. I don't know what the score is out there. It's just ridiculous. They're not having lives. It's terrifying. It's really terrifying. And the level of acceptance of all this behaviour is what shocks me most. This is their lives, and this will have repercussions for the rest of their lives. They'll become different people off the back of this.
Well, yeah. I mean, what about the kids who like are 4 years old when it hit, or 3 years old when it hit 2 years ago, and they're now accustomed to that. Like, you've got to disinfect your hands all the fucking time. You've got to wear a mask when you go outdoors. You've got to keep your distance from other people. That is going to fuck them up. Yeah, surely. Yeah. I don't know how that can't have, that's not going to result in deep-seated psychological issues for huge numbers of people.
Yeah, you've got those overbearing mothers even in the 80s, and their kids were already showing signs of their mums making them, you know, their hygiene-obsessed parents. And now you're going to have a generation of that. You know, in the early 80s and late 70s, I had one bath a week. And not through choice, that was it. That's all you were allowed. I had one school shirt, and that was most of my school, you know. I think that sort of, you know, that says a lot about the era. We weren't, you know, when I first heard about people having showers and a shower before school, I was kind of embarrassed for them a little bit. I just thought, this doesn't seem a decision you've made for a reason. It feels like it's been pushed on to you.
Yeah, I can understand. I mean, where does it end? You know, this is the scary thing about COVID is that it has changed our culture. This is now the standard. And certainly if there's another pandemic, they'll do all of the same stuff again. But even this one hasn't ended. Right now, Britain is in a sort of partial lockdown. Scotland is in, you know, they've got the masks everywhere.
I don't see it lasting. I don't see it lasting. I know that might be a bit optimistic, and I know it already has lasted far longer than it should have done. I mean, where I am, there's nothing happening. There's businesses are being put up, hotels are being built, the streets are full of people, bars are full every night. They're calling Cambodia the next big Asian success story. You know, they think it will be like Singapore or Malaysia in about 20 years. Average age of a Cambodian is about 27 because of the Khmer Rouge and all that. So there's no aging population causing, it sounds awful, but causing the problems that an aging population does cause. It's a very community-based culture. The police don't get involved in communities. They don't need to because the community deals with problems. But I'm worried that external governments might start imposing sanctions, because if places like this are showing that there's another way of dealing with it, that's not going to make the West look very good. But I think it's going to end. I really do. I just think that they'll milk it for all it's worth, and then they'll move on to the next thing.
Well, the next thing is apparently going to be climate change. But on that issue about the, you know, the rest of the world seeing the West fucking up, that's going to be a major topic for... I'm going to have a guy on who has a channel called The Franklin. He used to have a channel called Reactionary Expat. And he's actually going to appear twice on Millennial this year. Another one with Pale Hominid. But he's going to be talking about that. Sorry. Excuse me. This is what happens when I vape a lot. Do you want to talk about for a wee minute?
Okay. Well, I don't even have nicotine in my vape. I'm literally addicted to lemon mint flavored steam. For someone who spent 2/3 of their adult life addicted to heroin, it's quite the elevation or decline. I'm not quite sure. One of the two.
Bit of a come down. But yeah, so as I was saying, The Franklin, we're going to talk about how, you know, the East sees the West, because he thinks that the West has sort of shown itself up as, well, at best incompetent with how it's handled COVID, but at worst, deeply fucking corrupt.
For sure.
I mean, what would you say? Like, do you see how, like, in Cambodia, how the West is viewed? So you can talk about Joe Biden as well if you want.
Well, the main topics that I like to enjoy, if we go out and I'm with a lot of Khmer people, you know, I talk to them about things like, you know, I'm a guest in this country. It's a privilege to be here. I am a second class citizen here. The locals will be put above me. If I drive my scooter into someone else's scooter, the Khmer will get the benefit of the doubt, as he should. It's his country. I'm a visitor. It's his country. But I try and talk to them about racism, and they simply cannot understand it, because it's something that they haven't really had to deal with. And when I talk to them, you know, I give them examples of things happening in England about, well, you know, from a massive range of things, and you know, they're blown away. They're absolutely blown away.
I'm guessing they have a very relaxed, sort of realistic attitude about racial differences.
Well, it's 98% Buddhist Khmer.
All right, okay, so they don't have, like, black gangs tearing up the city streets.
There's almost no Africans here. They'll outright tell you they don't like Africans. They'll just say
that's what I mean. Like, how do they know that if there are hardly any of them there?
Because they because why are they here? Because no one will employ them. If you're in a bar and three or four Africans walk in, they are very rude. They demand the music be changed. They order the girls around with their fingers clicking, and everyone else, all the barangs, which is European people, leave. And then the girls pretend that the bar's closed. No, bar's closed. And then they leave, and then 5 minutes later the bar's open and the barangs come back and we get on as if that was just a little blip. They don't like them because no one will employ them. They've seen them be violent. They've seen them cause trouble, and they don't want it. I mean, in 4 years, I've probably seen about 20.
Right.
You know, so they're aware of certain patterns of behaviour that they've seen and that they've spoken to each other about. I mean, the beautiful thing about this place is just the way they express their exclusive culture. Culture is meant to be exclusive. It functions to say, we are us, you are not. And out here, there's a Buddhist festival, I'd say at least once a month. Now, that might be one day, that might be 1 week. Everyone gets time off work. And, that there's like the festival of ancestors where they will go back 7 or 8 generations. And because this is done every year, the children know their own ancestors going back 7 or 8 generations. And they do this to say, this is us. And I explain to them that in England, for instance, I say, in England, our cultural practices are threatened because they exclude people who've moved to our country. So, for instance, if the situation in Cambodia was like it was in England, I could complain that your festival of ancestors doesn't include me and it offends me. So you'll have to stop doing it. And they just all go, ah! Like about 20 of them, as if it's the funniest thing ever. And I'm like, yeah, that's...
Well, you know, when you say it, it does sound fucking mad.
Yes.
But, you know, here in the West, we're so acclimatized to that we just take it for granted that, yeah, of course they're going to moan that they're being left out and they don't see themselves represented in our culture and on our TVs. And of course, there are going to be white people feeling really guilty about it. It's just sort of, we're so used to it at this point. I think even in the 90s, people would have been quite used to that. And, well, definitely in the 2000s. It's been like that for ages now. If we get through this, we're going to look back on this. Like, our descendants are going to look back on this and just be in disbelief at the way that we destroyed ourselves in order to placate foreigners who weren't even that bothered about it if it hadn't been for this culture set up for them, for their grievances, I don't think they would have even moaned about it, to be honest.
I lived next to a couple of Muslims when I lived in Soho, a couple of nice blokes, and they said that one day they said, we're leaving England, and I was a bit gutted because, you know, I'd lived there 10 years, we'd built up a relationship. And so the first question, of course, was why? And they said, too many foreigners. And I can really, I know that's kind of a joke, but I can understand that because in Cambodia, there's not a lot of foreign people living here. You get tourists, obviously, but it's not like Thailand has got a massive expat community that has almost taken over certain areas. But here, you know, I'm quite the outsider, and I really respect and appreciate Cambodian culture, you know. And it's interesting you say in years we'll look back at this period and say what the fuck was happening, but going back to that hypnotic kind of information thing and Fukuyama's end of history, we don't look back anymore. We know now. Now, it used to be the case that because of the way information was dealt with in the past, it used to be the case that it would come out 10, 20 years later and you'll be like, fuck me, now we've got the full picture. Wasn't that crazy? But now that happens in the present. Where you're in the craziness and you know it. You know, it's that. I find that a bizarre thing. I don't think anyone, even your pro-vaxxers, your pro-maskers, what, I don't even know what they're fucking called at the moment. You know, they know that it's all gone wrong. But one second, because I thought at some point my missus is going back to the provinces, so she's going to interrupt me briefly, but it wasn't then. You know, there's no looking back at this being crazy. It is already. Look at last year's BLM riots. I mean,
I wonder. I think that ordinary people think, yeah, that woke stuff is mad. It's just silly. But then it just becomes the norm, and it has become the norm. And I don't really, I honestly don't know how ordinary people view it. I think they tend to think, okay, it's probably not as bad as I fear it is. You know, it's probably, I'll send my kid to school. They won't be going on about it there. You know, whatever. I think people just minimize it in their heads.
I'm not so sure. I am the eternal optimist, but I done a stream the other day, the normies want their lives back. And it was a stream of optimism, because it's now got to the point where the PTA meetings are being investigated by the FBI. And that is directly affecting normal people's lives. You don't need to be politically engaged to know that there's something wrong with that. You don't need to be politically engaged to know that when a bloke's daughter was raped by a bloke in a dress in the girls' toilets, the school covered it up, moved him to another school. He'd done it again. When he complained about it, the police got him on the ground, handcuffed him and dragged him out of the PTA meeting. That, you can't normalise that and say, no, I think, and also when you go to fill your car up, how much? Hang on a minute. Last year it was, you know.
This is a point that Morgoth made about COVID in Australia, because he was saying about the rounding people up and dragging them out their houses and all this. And he said they can't go back to normal after this, because no one is going to forget this. No one is going to forget that era when we did these things to each other. It's like a Rubicon has been crossed. They can't now pretend that it didn't happen. I don't know. I really wonder about that. I think that the West is probably going to endure a period of nasty tyranny. And I only hope, I don't really see how it can, I mean, I was just reading an article today about how the UK government is sort of gearing up for this. And I don't see how it can be averted. So my hope is that it just won't last very long. And I suspect it won't, because tyrannies don't tend to last very long. They tend to be an aberration in a society's history, because they're so extreme and so unnatural that, you know, human nature rebels one way or another.
Yeah, no, that I think that's the point I was making. I think that people are onto this now. I think that phrase, the normies want their life back, and also something that Morgoth said, I think he said, the cuck stops here. And I think that's really where people are at the moment. I think my missus is about to say goodbye to me. Apologies. Give me 20 seconds.
All right. Okay.
Sorry, that was really awkward, and I shouldn't have put that on you. I heard you going, okay.
No. No, 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 no. It's fine. I was just I was checking other stuff. Don't worry, it's fine. It's fine.
Well, maybe it was projection. It was really awkward for me. Let's put it like that.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I don't worry about it. So yeah, well, I hope that this is an aberration, but I do think it's going to happen in Britain and the West. Because the infrastructure is being put in place. I mean, they're going for this QR code scanners and all that in supermarkets. The digital ID seems to be a thing. I don't know. I just fucking pray it's not something that lasts forever.
Well, half of it's not even enforceable. I mean, you know, I spend quite a lot of time on the dark web, and, you know, you can get Vax passports on there for $100. Legit ones as well. They're not copies. They're what the Thais call genuine fakes. So they've been signed off by doctors. So the QR code will work if you get to the passport office when you if you want to leave the country and they scan it. A doctor has sat there and just written hundreds of these off and got himself a holiday in the Maldives out of it.
I just want to emphasize, I don't want anyone to think that I'm recommending that to anyone. Just in case, for legal reasons, I'm not advocating breaking
so
the law.
So what you're saying is do not download the Tor browser, get on the dark...
absolutely not. Absolutely not. Only white supremacists do that kind of thing.
You know, we had it the other day. I'm sure you've seen the video of the German police walking around with their social distancing sticks. I didn't see that.
What I did see was people in Britain walking around with a flat screen TV attached to them over their heads, blaring out messages about COVID. And that was just like something out of Monty Python.
I mean, they're in Germany now. They've got, two things I can tell you about Germany. One from a bloke who lives in Germany, the other one from seeing it. The German police are walking around. They've got these sticks about a metre and a half high, and they're walking around and they are putting them in between groups of people to make sure they're adequately social distancing. However, you can hear everyone laughing. It's like, look at you in all that combat gear, essentially that military hardware you're done up in, and you're making sure people are standing apart from each other. The second one, and this is from someone who lives in Germany, and he sent me the link. I think it was from the Gateway Pundit, if you want to check it out. In German schools now, they're getting the kids to stand up at the front of the class and say whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated. And if they're unvaccinated, why? Now, that, again, the effect that's going to have on their kids. And also then that puts pressure on the kids to go home in tears and say, Mom, Dad.
The kids are going to hate their parents for doing that to them, for putting them in that position.
Exactly.
Just let me get vaccinated, Mummy. It's fucking sick. And again, it has these shades of totalitarianism about it. It's the kind of thing that a dictatorial regime would do in the schools. And of course, it's all how insidious it is to do it via the children like that, to make the children suffer. It's fucking sick.
It hasn't got shades of totalitarian. This is totalitarianism. It's happening.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't mean to downplay it. It is sinister as fuck.
And of course, the likes of Zuckerberg is already trying to, exploit this with his new mega. What's it? Meta. Oh, you don't need to live in that dirty, infectious real world. You know, now you'll be able to live in the virtual reality that I'll tell you this now, that's never working. It's never going to work. No one was impressed when it was on Tomorrow's World in 1978. It's 2021. No one wants to walk around with these stupid headsets going, oh, hello, Jennifer, you've got lovely hair. But that's what he's trying to do now. It's such a dirty place out there, such a scary place. I mean, we created the mess and now here's the solution. You know, you can just sit at home and live in that virtual world. This is something that's quite kind of, what would the word be? I don't know, but sort of typical of this era. Is the people that create the problems then create the solutions. You know, it's almost the perfect business model.
The other people you're looking for endemic or characteristic?
Characteristic, there you go. It's very much characteristic of this era that the people that cause the problems then offer the solutions. The other one, of course, is I think they're the Purdue family who invented Oxycontin. Now, Oxycontin... Again, as someone with, as a heroin connoisseur, shall we say, I can't help but think that the brief to the pharmacists was make heroin, because you can chase OxyContin like on a foil like you do heroin. You can snort OxyContin like you can heroin. You can inject OxyContin. It's It's laboratory non-opium based heroin, essentially. And it's devastated America. And not only has it devastated America because of the tablets, but obviously what happens is that when the doctors say, no, you can't have a new script, or B, you can't afford it because your kids are starving, then you have to, you know, that's a terrible, painful, hell-like withdrawal. So you go and buy heroin because it's cheaper, or fentanyl because it's cheaper. So they've caused such a disaster. You know, it's such a disaster. But the same family of who own that business, they've now created a drug that will get you off of OxyContin. However, and here's the clincher, it's maintenance. So you don't get off it, you're on something else for life. So keep paying. Keep
Wow. So it's a palliative. So they get you hooked on this thing and then there's no permanent cure. Fuck.
Yeah, it's like methadone, really. You know, methadone was originally meant to be like a sort of a temporary intervention so that you don't have to go and thieving to pay for your drugs, and then you slowly taper it down. But coming off of methadone is far harder than coming off of heroin. The methadone detox lasts about 3 months and it's agony. And so pretty much everyone I know who got a methadone script is still on it 10, 20, 30 years later. And the money in that game. And so now they've got a methadone for OxyContin. You know, they've pulled the same stunt again. Same family. It's quite something.
Fucking hell. There are some questions from the audience. Okay. In what way do you consider the Cold War to have never ended? Because I think you said it never really ended. I don't know if you meant that.
Well, I mean, I think what I meant, in as much as there is still a threat of nuclear war, that looms over the planet. I'm no CND man, but it was Peter Hitchens who actually told me on the telephone, really weird name drop there, the whole thing about MAD, mutually assured destruction. So it got to the point where, you know, yes, you can destroy the United States by turning two keys or whatever, but in the meantime, we'll be sending some back to you and we're all fucked. And it's called MAD, mutually assured destruction. And Hitchens said to me that it's the fact that everyone has nukes now that makes us safer. And there's an argument there. However, when you bring Islam into that, when you bring Iran into that, who have a very different cultural relationship with death, that mutually assured destruction doesn't terrify them so much. That is part that's almost a benefit to it. You know, let's kill the infidels. Yeah, we'll die too, but I'll see you in heaven, brother.
With the virgins. So,
exactly. And also now with, you know, modern nukes like the ones China are working on, which is a thing that apparently, you know, it was a bit of a scant article and I kind of skipped read it, but they're looking at these satellite things that just go round and round. There is... I think the article was saying with maybe now, but if not within a matter of years, mutually assured destruction is off the cards because they can launch and before you know it is too late. So you haven't got that sort of time span to, you know, pay them back, as it were.
Yeah.
So I think it was a bit flippant to use the Cold War because I think that is Soviet America essentially. But I think I meant just the nuclear threat is a thing that we live with. You know, I don't think we're ever going to see many. Well, maybe. I was going to go down a blind alley there.
Okay, clearly we live with this threat, but it's not on everyone's minds from day to day. Like I think it was during the 80s that we could, you know, a bomb could just appear out of the sky tomorrow and everything I know is gone. strangely is not on people's minds, even though the, scientifically it's much more of a possibility now than it was in the 80s.
But isn't that just a question of who, you know, let's say the COVID thing does sort of peter out and people start just saying, nah, fuck it, I'm not doing it. And then if enough people do that, I think it will kind of just crumble and disappear and they'll look for the next one. If the powers that be decided to ramp up the fear of nuclear, it would be on everyone's minds. You know, I think it's just a question of it's not there. It's not in the pop music. It's not on the 6 o'clock news. You know, it's not around, but it's still there. And as you said, the scientific and cultural probability of it happening is increasing daily.
Well, China, the thing that I think I saw the same article as you, they a couple, like 2 months ago, they launched a missile that I think it went around the Earth maybe twice. It went out into whatever that's called, the stratosphere, and I can't remember now, but it was a new type of missile, and the White House actually said, we have no idea how they did this. And I was surprised at the White House saying that, you know, that's a really embarrassing admission for them to make. So first of all, they've got they don't know how they did this, but they've also got the incompetence of openly saying we don't know how they did this. Because, you know, if you had competent people in charge, they'd be saying, don't act scared. Don't act like we didn't know about this. Don't act like this is outside of our understanding, because that will only make us look bad.
Yeah.
They went and did it.
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about an administration that telephones China and lets them know if America's going to do any aggressive manoeuvres. And that bloke still got his job. It's, again, the madness of it all and the transparency of it all. They don't care. But, yeah, what a weird thing to say.
Yeah, really weird. Okay, here's a fairly generic question that I'm sure you've been asked before. What do you think attracts men like yourself and On the Offensive and Snorkel Blog to the East?
For me, there's a few reasons, and it's kind of, I've only sort of learned them in retrospect, but the women are feminine and they're traditionally feminine. You know, I never wanted a family in England. I never wanted it. Now, that has got a lot to do with my 80s upbringing, for sure. I'm not sort of taking myself and my own agency out of the equation. I did obviously get into hard drugs very early, which, you know, isn't great for that sort of thing. But, you know, the girls I was with in England, and this isn't all of them, obviously, but the whole feminism has destroyed the relationships between men and women in the West. It doesn't work very well. I don't think it works very well. When I met this girl, you know, we've been together 4 years. It's been like a godsend. She's feminine and she understands the different roles we'd have in a family. And I suddenly thought, well, hang on, this sounds like a lovely idea. You know, I could actually get into this. And we are, we are planning a family. So that's one reason. The other reason is I cause a lot of problems in England, and there's a lot of people who would like to hurt me, and so that was quite a good reason to get out. And also, it's lovely here. It's hot all year round, and I'm nearly 50, and I get very, very depressed when those. You know, I kind of get nostalgic for them now because I haven't had to experience them. But when the clocks go back or forward, I can never remember. And it starts getting dark at 3 o'clock. I'm a very miserable person. And to have, you know, it's equatorial here. It's sunny all year round. And that motivated me without a doubt.
Yeah. I think what you said about men, women having an understanding of the, you know, gender roles. Of course, men in the West today don't have an understanding of gender roles. So and then that makes things worse between men and women, because the women don't know what's expected of them, and yeah, it's exponential. But I think you're absolutely right. If when you meet a woman who does have an understanding of this and is perfectly okay with it, perfectly happy with it, and wants to be that. It's interesting because at first you don't really want to go along with it because it's like, it's a bit, well, where's the tension? Where's the pushback? Where's the gutsy attitude that I expect of modern women? But then eventually you realize, oh no, it's not supposed to be like that. It's actually, she's supposed to be submissive. She's supposed to want to help me.
It's like a surprise. It's like an epiphany when you realize that, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a lovely thing. And I this is what I would say to young guys. If you find a woman like that and she's good, and you like being with her and you're attracted to her, if you're turned on by her, and if she's not manipulative, if she doesn't play games, if those four things are in place, just go for it. Just go for it.
That's a unicorn in England at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately.
But also, you know, I'm part of a community, weirdly. And it's lovely. You know, I grew up in a community in my street. We knew everyone on that street's names. All the doors were open from spring and summer. And as a young boy, I'd run in and out of all the houses. And it was bliss. And that, you know, my mum still lives in that house on that street. And she barely knows a soul on that road. Whereas here, even in the 4 years I've been here, and I am an outsider, obviously, but I wear traditional Cambodian clothing, really. It's kind of a joke, but it's also very practical. And everyone around here is really nice to me. They'll tell me if they saw something that they think I should be aware of. And it's nice to be part of a community. I think we're social creatures. You know, because I realised that was over, I ended up living in Soho. I thought I'd take advantage of the other extreme, you know, go to the heart of the city where it's, you know, it's like Mega City 4. It's just you're distracted by chaos and you're distracted by cultural sort of diversions. And you know, and that was fine during my 30s and early 40s. But as I got a bit older, I just thought, I've kind of had enough of this. I actually want to come back and find out who I am.
Yeah, and I think for most guys, it would probably come earlier than that. It would probably come younger than that. I mean, I know guys who have partied throughout their 20s, and they're now in their late 20s or their 30s, and they just want to settle down. You know, if you've had 10 years of that, that seems to be more than enough for most people. I know guys in their late 20s who are just desperate now to get out of the city, settle down, have a wife, have a kid, have a home. It is a phase that a lot of people have to go through, because otherwise you wonder about it. And if you haven't had it and you're of that nature, inquisitive, adventurous, then you will wonder about it. But
although I think it's important for men to live their lives. You know, we haven't got a biological clock ticking as fast as women have. You know, in the scene I was part of a year or so ago, it was all, you know, get married, have kids in your 20s. No, I'd say no. I'd say live your life, travel, you know, experience yourself in the face of strangers, which is a very different thing to experiencing yourself in familiar company. Do different jobs, try different projects, take some risks. And then, I wouldn't say there's an ideal age, but I'd certainly advise young men to live before you settle down, because it probably won't work if you get involved too early.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I would say most guys get that stuff over with in your 20s. Try to be settled, you know, or be settling down when you're like 30.
I'd put 10 years on that. I'd say late 30s.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but
I know it's different perspectives.
You've got more chance of becoming independently wealthy, or more chance of creating passive revenue streams if you've had a bit more time on the planet, which is going to make having a family, which is going to make having a relationship, which is difficult. Relationships ain't easy. It's a fucking compromise, but there's pros and cons, obviously. But I think without, you know, in our culture today, money equates to choices and choices equate to freedoms. And if you haven't got a lot of that, it's going to put so much pressure on raising a family. So I'd give yourself a little bit more time to get a little bit of, to get those revenue streams set up. That's the only distinction, I think. Yeah. If you're minted by the time you're 30, then crack on, yes. But if you're not, then you've got 10 more years.
I would also say it depends how much you can cram into your 20s, because, you know, if you can get a lot done, in my case, I didn't. And, that's had long-term implications. But if you are, if you have a more normal 20s and you do a lot of adventuring and, you know, all that stuff, then I think you'd be much more ready to settle down by, you know, your early 30s. But what was the other? There was another. Oh yeah. So about women though, it just is different. It simply is a very different game, just for biological reasons. I mean, it doesn't even matter how you feel about it. It's just a biological reality. And I don't think we need to go into that really, but it should be obvious to everyone. Some people say, oh, well, you're saying it's different for men and women. Well, it fucking is. It just is. What can you say? There was another question. Let me see if I can find it now. Someone said, here he is. That was right back at the start. They were excited to see you.
Thanks.
Here he is. Exclamation mark. So that was quite sweet. Is Southeast Asia doing all right these days? How's the poverty, or is it growing more wealthy? How has the lack of tourists due to COVID affected it?
Okay, first thing I need to say, there's a little bit of construction work going on. Hopefully when I talk, you won't notice it, and I'll mute in between. But I have to be a little bit careful because I'm here as a guest and it's a privilege, but I can't speak for Vietnam and Thailand. I know little bits about it, but probably not enough to give you something worth hearing. But certainly in Cambodia, the economy is flying. You know, as I said earlier, with the average age of someone about 27, many economists are saying Cambodia will be the next big Asian success story, like Malaysia, Singapore. There's a lot of money to be made here. There's, you know, I look at the West and I hear about the economy and the inflation and all that, and I get on my scooter and drive around Phnom Penh, and there's just hotels going up, businesses opening, and foreigners can do that here like they can't in Thailand. You can in Thailand, but you have to jump through hoops and you have to get a broker involved who sort of owns a business, but you really do, and it gets a bit complicated. But over here, you can come out here with a very small amount of money, and if the idea is good, you can implement that and take advantage of what is a very positive culture. I mean, I wouldn't know that there was a bubonic plague going on unless I watched the internet. From my day-to-day experience out here, I wouldn't know. And I think that kind of sums it up, really.
Right, okay. I thought that was the case. I've heard that from other people living just outside of the West, that there are no signs left of COVID, really. It's something that happened a year and a half ago. And now it's back to basically life as normal again. Whereas for in the West, it's just dragging on and on.
I don't know whether I said this earlier in this stream or before we started, but I do have a slight fear that Western governments might start looking at the situation here and in other places and start putting a little bit of pressure on countries like Cambodia, because, you know, they're upsetting the apple cart a little bit with this whole thing. And, you know, they have the power to impose sanctions. You know, you impose trade sanctions on somewhere like Cambodia, it will be devastating. There was a bit of the question I didn't answer. Oh, I'm so sorry about that noise. There was something else I wanted to. Someone said something. Oh, I can't remember.
Hold on a minute, I'll find it. It's how's the poverty? Is it growing more wealthy? How has the lack of tourists affected it?
Right, that was the bit. So, I mean, there is extreme poverty here still, without a doubt. You know, you'll see homeless kids running around the streets at midnight in the red light areas collecting plastic. For a kilo of plastic, they get a dollar. And so you'll see people doing that. You'll see entire families where everyone throws their rubbish, their black bags. There's certain points where you throw them. We don't have wheelie bins or anything. And these piles can get quite big. And you'll see a family turn up with like a little cart that they've made on a couple of bicycle wheels. And they'll rip all those bags open. Children, toddlers, grandmothers, just getting anything out of it they can recycle. When they've gone, that pile's almost disappeared because most of that stuff. So you have got people at that end of the spectrum, and you've got people getting very rich. You know, I've got a Khmer friend who drives around in like this, you know, this lovely Mercedes, and he's got a couple of properties. He's looking at buying another one. My landlord has got 60 properties. You know, he's 28 and he rents out 60 properties. I mean, you know. So there is still a massive, from the very rich to the very poor, that still exists. However, there's no welfare here. There's none. If you don't earn money, you die. If you don't earn money, you don't eat. And what that has done to this country is magnificent, because people get busy. You have to. And some of the things that I've seen, the way people have made money, and you know, it's funny that you hear about feminists in the West. We want the jobs. No, you want the good jobs. Out here, I have seen women who must have been at least 60 years old laying bricks, you know, and odd carrying, because they have to work, you know. But, you know, if you haven't got that stupid safety net, which has done so much damage to Europe, you know, humans are good at surviving if given the motivation, and eating is quite a good motivation. So people out here are very resourceful, you know, that they'll make money. Like, I'm looking at setting up a little business out here. There's, I don't think I've got one here. There's this thing called a galan. It's they get bamboo, they fill it full of sticky rice, there's a bit of jackfruit in there, a few black beans, a bit of coconut juice. It's roasted on a charcoal sort of barbecue kind of thing for 6 hours. They take the outside off and they sell them, and I think it's something like $2.50 for a kilo. When I go to the one place in Phnom Penh that you can get galan, every time I'm there, there's a queue 20 strong. So me and my girlfriend are talking about finding someone who can make them, setting up a stall in the center of Phnom Penh rather than having to drive all the way out to that place, market the hell out of them with phone numbers, get someone on a scooter to deliver them. You know, I'm projecting a turnover of about $300 a day and a profit of about $220 a day, 6 days a week. You know, it starts looking quite good. But you could come out here and do a million things like that, you know. So there is still poverty, but there's ways of getting out of it. That option's there. Whereas in England, if you're very poor, you get caught in the welfare trap, you get demotivated, and you know many people stay in it for life. There's families in those old coal mining towns that have got three generations of people who've never worked.
Yeah, it's
heartbreaking.
It's so depressing. There was another question. Oh yeah, someone said your stream schedule is one hell of an undertaking and must leave you exhausted. Have some money. Well, thank you very much. And yes, it does. It is one hell of an undertaking. So if people would like to give something back, that would be appreciated.
Can we just talk about that, Woz, for a minute? This might work out well for you. When I was internationalism, I mean, that's a weird way of saying it. I mean, I'm certainly not a globalist. I think the the nation state model works preferable over globalism. But the amount of shit I got for asking for donations was ridiculous. I mean, now I just call it the grift. At every start of my stream, I go, right, let's get the doors of griftation open. And I've got a set little thing that I say. And towards the end of it, I say, I put a lot of time, effort, passion and research into these streams. And I would appreciate a few donations. And you don't hear people on the left getting called out for that. They are happy to give money to each other, because if you donate to people, they can justify putting more time into what they do, and then they can do more good in that area. And I do watch left-wing streams because I want to know what nonsense they're on with next. And the money's, you know, and I've seen so many nationalist streams where they're going, he's a grifter, this bloke's a grifter, look at him asking for money. Woz is streaming four times a day. Forget about actually doing the streams. The organisation that must have gone into this every year is incredible. So, yeah, if, you know, I haven't streamed for a couple of days. If you're one of my viewers, give Woz what you would have given me over the last couple of days. It's a lot of work. And that what's the word? Just making people feel bad about getting some donations is bullshit. And it hobbles us. It hobbles creators like us. It's just stupid. It's stupid. Sorry, I got real bee in my bonnet about that.
No, you're right. And there's so much that could be said about this or moaned about this that, you know, on the left, there's so much fucking money. It's eye-watering. You know, they have Patreon. They have PayPal. They have it's, and, you know, these people like ContraPoint, like thousands of donors on Patreon. It's the money they must be making is just unbelievable. With Millennial, I mean, I will say this was like two or three months preparation work was involved in this. And it was every day. And now I'm doing the actual streaming and it's four a day. So yeah, if you would like to donate, I certainly would appreciate it.
I've been trying to set a stream up with Semiagog. It's taken 5 months and we still haven't got it sorted. So good Lord knows how you get all this sorted. But the word I was looking for is donation shaming. You don't see it so much in America. Salty Crackers taking like 20, 25 grand a stream. And so he should. It's his full-time job. But in England, it's just... And what really riles me about it is it's part of that working class thing as well. You know, you shouldn't be getting money. You're just sitting in a chair. It's like, for fuck's sake, why don't you help? What, you know, you're watching it. You consume the product.
And also, if you think it's easy, have a go at it. Just fuck off.
Just fuck off.
It's so infuriating. I think there's this awful crabs in the bucket mentality, which has been, you know, a feature of, you know, right wing YouTube, right wing social media for as long as I've been involved in it. I don't know where it comes from. It might well be a certain British mentality. I don't know. I think in America they're more accustomed to the idea of, you know, the go getter. He's got energy. Why wouldn't he get paid for it? Why shouldn't he expect it? It's like there's a certain shame attached to asking for money, I guess.
Yeah. The Salty Cracker was hilarious. The other week he was taking so many donations. He called out the Texas governor and said, look, hit me up. I'll sign off a check to finish the wall. He's on tonight's donations. Yeah, grift shaming, ridiculous. But yeah, move on from that one. Any more questions?
I haven't actually heard of... Well, I've heard the name Salty Cracker, but I haven't looked. I have no idea who it is. This is another thing. I'm not bemoaning my ban from YouTube. Don't worry about it. I'm, you know, it didn't disturb me like the Twitter ban did 3 years ago. It didn't fuck me up. It's fine. It's a reality. I'm used to it, whatever. But one of the practical after effects of it is that you're just unplugged from that whole thing. I just don't know what, like, I hear about people who are now, and you know, who are now YouTube names, you know, their faces, and I've never heard of them. And it's only, 10 months ago that I got banned. That's how quickly things evolve.
Yeah, that is, yeah, I don't want to lose my YouTube channel. There's a lot of things important there for me. I mean, Salty Cracker streamed on Odyssey a few weeks ago and had 25,000 people watching. His model is to stream on YouTube, start the stream live on YouTube, and then halfway through he says, right, we're now going over to Odyssey. He puts a link in, and most people follow him. It's a good model, I think. But holding on to his YouTube channel is key for that to continue working for the time being. I think at some point he'll migrate fully to Odyssey.
Yeah, I mean I've said to people who are still on YouTube, use it while you can, but use it to get people to move over to Odyssey, because at some point you are going to get banned from YouTube. I mean, it's just going to happen to everyone. I think YouTube is going to end up just being the mainstream media on the internet, with a few sort of innocuous like DIY channels strewn amongst it, maybe prank videos, but that'll be it.
Well, it's like their unwanted baby, isn't it? Alphabet and Google. They created this thing that is a real pain in the ass for them. You know, the opposition ideology utilizes that platform far better than the one they try to support, you know, with their fake trending, their shadow banning. You know, the Young Turks, 5 million subscribers, they get like 2,000 people watching them live. Half of them are hate watching. And so, but the problem is YouTube can't get rid of YouTube, because then BitChute, Odyssey, someone else gets the top of the tree. So they have to keep it. And, you know, they've just got rid of the dislike. And again, we go back to that transparency thing. You know, you can't dislike something now. And they said, oh, well, we've done this for new creators, because what happens is there's organized dislikes.
As if they're bothered about the mental health of creators. You know, I was stressed out of my fucking mind throughout. For the last year, I was okay, because I was just accepting, yeah, I'm going to get banned. I sort of came to terms with it. But prior to that, the 2 years prior to that, I was up the fucking wall. I mean, it went from being the best job in the world. I felt so lucky. I felt so lucky that I was able to live from doing this thing that I loved. And it went from being that to just being a fucking, like, a constant source of stress and fear. Throughout like 2017, 18, and I think throughout maybe like after 2019, I was okay, and 2019 as well. And then 2020, I was okay. I sort of accepted it. But for those like 2018 and 19, I was just, it was awful. It was just a nightmare. I think I'm going to lose my livelihood. And so fuck these cunts. I mean, how dare they say that they care about people's mental health? It's so dishonest.
They don't give a shit.
Cunts. Yeah, sorry, I've ranted. That's me. I've done it.
No, I think what you've said is really important, because it's kind of been a bait and switch, YouTube. Thanks for building it up, but now you lot can fuck off. And even the strike system doesn't, you know, it's obviously a lie. It's obviously used to get rid of people. You know, if the video is not accepted according to their terms of service, just delete it. Surely that's all right. What's the problem? No, they want to get shot of prominent and opposition voices.
Yeah, the getting rid of the dislikes thing is just a way of hiding how unpopular something is. That's really all it's about. It's a political move. I don't believe for a second that they care about people's mental health.
If you're a new YouTuber and you make a bit of content and it gets 500 dislikes, you know not to make it again. It's helpful. You know, when I was a stand-up for 10 years, and if I have a bad gig, that's when I learn, okay, that material doesn't work.
Imagine if instead you'd done 20 shows, and then all at once you got all the bad feedback from all those shows and you realized, oh my God, and then you had no career left. That's effectively what the YouTube strike system is, that they can just fuck you up, which is what they kind of, well, they did do this with me, but they even broke their own rules with me, because they did it with three separate channels. But it's meant to be three strikes per channel. But with me, they did it one strike for three channels. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
The point is
that they can fuck you up by giving you three strikes at once, and then there's nothing you can do about it. You know, sorry, go on.
They gave me a strike for a video I'd already deleted. Because my channel's still monetized.
That's interesting because I thought that when you delete a video, that's it. It is no longer on there. Like, they don't know anything about it after that. Well, that must be a lie as well.
There was a couple of weird things that happened. Once everyone's channels were getting shut down, I thought, all right, put all of your dodgy stuff private. And then someone said to me that they can still see those. If they're private, you've got to delete them. So I deleted loads of them. And then when I re-upped a load, one of them linked to the Iconoclast and one of them linked to Atheism is Unstoppable. And one of the new terms of service is you're not allowed to link to people who are banned or something weird like that. So I got two strikes. For re-up. And I said to him, but you didn't mind that they were on my platform last week, but now I've re-uploaded them because you've changed blah blah blah. But one of the videos I deleted, this was a separate incident about a year later. I don't want to talk about YouTube too much because we've all heard it, but I realized that one video was probably a bit spicy for the new, you know, this week's YouTube, so I deleted it. And about 4 days later, I got a strike for that video, and because I'm a partner, I can talk to them. So I talked to them and I said, I've just had a strike for a video I deleted 5 days ago. And she said, yeah, but we'd already made our mind up that that one deserves a strike before you deleted it.
For fuck's sake. So, but they hadn't issued the strike.
Yeah, exactly that, yeah. So, yeah.
I don't even know what to make of that, because you'd think that they would issue the strike so as to, you know, fuck you up more. Because then, you know. Yeah, I don't know, but I think they were just lying there. I think that's just bullshit.
Funny though, because when you talk to them, you know what kind of people they are, and sometimes I just play with it. You know, I just sort of say, I talk about how hurt my feelings were, and that, you know, I have anxiety, and they will just go with it because they know that if they say because they've set their own bar at such a stupid level. I say to them, I've had trouble sleeping, I've had to see my doctor, my psychologist says, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, we are so sorry, you know, we didn't mean to cause you. And I'm just sitting again, you idiots.
But the thing is, with a lot of people, that's actually true. You know, as I say, I had 2 years of fucking nonstop worry about it. I'm not going to say I needed a therapist or whatever, although, to be honest, I probably did. Now that I say it, I probably did. I mean, I remember at one point I was actually like asking for donations so that I could get a therapist, and then I just didn't get enough, so I didn't do it. But yeah, I was that stressed. I mean, that these people, oh fuck. There's no point moaning about it, is there? I mean, it's, you know, in a way, see, this is what I mean. This is when I said that in a way it's a relief to be off it. That's not just a cope. In a way, I genuinely am relieved because I just don't need to think about this anymore.
And the response, again, you know, the response has been great. I mean, BitChute, I think I've got Ray Vahi coming on my stream tomorrow. You know, they're like something like the 800th most visited website in America. And this is just two blokes who do it in their part time. And now we've got Odyssey, and now they're and Rumble. I think Rumble's about to go down the pan because they partnered up with someone, so I think Rumble might be over.
Yeah, I think so.
But you know, these alternatives are there. And when I go to BitChute, it's like YouTube was in the early days. You can actually be shocked. You can watch something and go, no! I remember watching Metacore's, I never know how to say his name.
Is this the one, Mr. Metacore? Is this the one about transgender?
What was beautiful, if no one's seen it, it's on BitChute, it's called How Sausages Are Made, and it goes into some visual graphic depth about the surgeries in transgenderism. Now, what I love about it is when you see these people on TV shows, and they're all well made up. They've got a wig, and it's always the passers. It's very rarely the. But when you find out things like you have to shave, it's a wound that's trying to heal forever, and it needs shaving. It needs. It's a very different picture to the one that legacy media like to tell us about this. I had a bloke on my channel a couple of years ago called Tarquin. Very interesting bloke who had mental health problems in his teenage years. The LGBT people absolutely clamped on him, like they did with that school in Brighton. There's a school in Brighton, and there's something like 60% of them are trans now. And something like 60% of the trans are autistic. So, you know, they prey on people who are struggling. And he took their advice and said, I'm a female, am I? I never realised. And when I interviewed him, he's like 55 now or something. I said to him, so what do you make of all this now? He said, well, now I'm just an old man without a cock. And I just thought, yeah, you are. How many more of these are we going to have?
Oh, God.
You know, I heard the other day that the UK government can overrule parents with children as young as three.
Yeah. I don't know what the law is there. I don't want to go on record saying anything about that because I don't know. But it wouldn't surprise me. And I know that the... you know, in America, there are these stories coming out about kids being bribed to get the vaccine against their parents, like without their parents' consent. That kind of stuff is going on. I think in Scotland, again, in Scotland and England, it's different laws. And I think in Scotland, there is something about how the parents are not allowed to prevent their kid from. But I don't know. Like transitioning, you know, but I don't know for sure, so I don't want to go on record saying anything.
No, fair point. And when I did preface it with I heard the other day, which is internet speak for someone told me.
Yeah. There was one other question. Oh yeah, so this is a big question. You can answer it as briefly as you like. How did you go from, and I'm sure this is a question you've had before, but here we go. How did you go from heroin to red pills? That's basically the story, like the whole arc of your life, I guess.
Well, I think thanks for the question, and thanks for all the questions. It's very kind. I think the more interesting bit is how did I go from communism to heroin? Because that happened first. And I was a member of the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party of Great Britain. When I was at Leeds, I used to sell Living Marxism, Brendan Thingy Bob's magazine that got sued out of existence by ITN, I think.
Yeah, Spiked Online. It was the Revolutionary Communist. Yeah, yeah. Is that the one?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, they used to have a magazine. It was originally called Living Marxism. They thought that Marxism was a bit heavy, so it changed to LM. But, you know, the first edition of that I was shilling at the Leeds Uni Freshers Week was about free speech and total free speech. The second copy I was selling was What's Wrong with Masculinity, and it had a picture of Tyson on the cover, and it was in support of masculinity. I mean, that's how bizarrely the left has changed in the space of 20, 30 years. But I was indoctrinated, not at my art school so much, but I had done my master's degree. I was only 22 when I started my master's degree in cultural studies, which is the precursor to what we now call social justice. You know, I studied feminism, I studied gender identity, I studied Marx, I studied postmodernism, poststructuralism. And I haven't actually thrown all that stuff away. I refuse to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I get a lot of jip for my... for what I say about Adorno. I think Adorno's written some amazing critiques of culture that are more relevant now than ever. However, there are some very snide things that go on in the communist camp. I will get to answer your question, but this is the first important bit. Where, you know, they tell you to engage with these arguments with family and friends, because that will alienate you from your family and friends, so you then rely on your communist, your comrades, essentially. And then there's this sort of really weird, for communists or Marxists, a really strange misunderstanding of the economy, because you're not allowed to enjoy your life because it's privileged. And if you've got something nice, someone in Guatemala hasn't. You know, they've got their zero-sum game around their necks. You know, none of them have read Das Kapital anyway. They get halfway through the Communist Manifesto and go, oh, no, that'll do. I can pass that off as parties. So I got into this really miserable way of life where you're not allowed to enjoy anything. You're not. You feel guilt. You know, communism, being a communist makes you feel guilty because you've stolen people's things, apparently. So you can't enjoy nice things in life. And that was the catalyst that ended up me going from a recreational drug user to needing to sedate myself with a drug that's mainly used for people who are dying. I kept hold of the communist thing, even though the political side of it dropped out. What the left have been very good at, that the right should really look into, is the romance of it. The movies, you know, all sorts of things like Ken Loach's Land and Freedom. You know, I'll still shed a tear when I watch that movie about when the Spanish came to England asking for people to go out and fight the fascists in Spain. And I kept hold of that side of it. You know, I'd still call myself a communist. This is even up until I was about early 30s. But I hadn't been engaged politically with anything for years because I was a smackhead. I had better things to do. Sounds weird, but in that context, it probably is. I think heroin is probably better than communism. It's the only thing. But anything is better than heroin except communism. So anyway, I totally disengaged politically. I'd set up a business while I was using, a successful bit, very successful business, right place, right time. The internet was just sort of opening up. I had a friend help me. And then one day, someone said to me, a good friend of mine said to me, "Do you know what a social justice warrior is?" And I said no. And he said, "Right, I'm going to send you some links." And he sent me, and this was just before Gamergate. He sent me, I think it was like Sargon and a couple of others. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, these are those fuckers I'd done my master's degree with who I didn't trust at the fucking time. This is those people. You know, when I was on my master's degree, it was a communist boot camp. You know, you didn't study Marx critically. You learn it. This is Marx. He's right. You don't study feminism. You learn it. It's not critical. You're not allowed to be. I used to be. And I was ostracized. You know, they just didn't like me on that course because I dare to say, well, hang on a minute, I don't know about that. And I thought, these are those fuckers. I was fucking right. I was absolutely right. I mean, it's a bit embarrassing, but I painted on my head potential rapist at one of my art schools and just walked around all day, and it all kicked off as expected. But when I started looking at all this sort of, you know, pre-Gamergate kind of the social justice warrior thing, I thought I was fucking right. They made me feel like I was an idiot and I was wrong and I wasn't getting something, but this is that now being exposed. You know, I studied critical race theory. You know, Stuart Hall, Edward Said, is it? You know, all that lot, the Birmingham School, who invented cultural studies. And at the time I was like... And so it was lovely to have these people. So, of course, almost overnight, the communism was gone. I saw through that facade almost instantly. Although, like I said, I hadn't been political with it for years. It was just something to pull birds. You know, if you're a communist at a party, they think, wow. I remember telling girls that I'd smuggled weapons to Afghanistan and things, and you know, they lapped that shit up. And so, yeah, that was it. A friend told me to check out a few YouTube channels, and that was the start of my journey.
All right. And was Sargon the start of that? Or was he the end destination?
I don't want to say that anything like that on record.
All right.
The end of that destination. But, you know, I still do think Sargon has a role to play. I really do.
Oh, of
I
course.
Think, you know, you can't bring normies in and say, oh, go and see so-and-so or go and see so-and-so because they're miles away from that.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
He's just really dull and nauseating, but, you know, regardless.
Well, I mean, I have to say I don't like his new stuff. I mean, I did prefer his early work. I mean, at this point, what really annoys me about Sargon is that he just lies about, you know, well, about people like me. That's the most annoying thing about it. But anyway, that's another.
But that one. But that whole time, then when Gamergate happened, it was just I hadn't been so politically excited since I was at art school and having arguments with people in the bar. You know, it was like there's something I can get my teeth into here, and it really did motivate me. I thought, hang on, I used to be political. What happened?
Yeah, and you know, on YouTube back then, you could do that. That's the thing. You couldn't. You couldn't do that nowadays. I don't think. I don't know. Maybe some people can get away with that. But yeah.
Well, you know, it's. A couple of years ago, I made a video saying, you know, we should maybe develop a lot of slang for talking on YouTube. And, you know, there was no organisation or preparation. But when people stream now, it's virtually encrypted. You know, most of what's said is encrypted. I mean, how many channels talking about jogging? I never knew, you know, I never knew going for a little run was so popular.
Yeah, jogging and the coof and the V, you know, it's fucking weird. Okay, so I'll just read out these last things here. So when you were talking about the virtue of donating, someone said, I can't disagree with what Chris is saying. And so thank you very much for that. That was
well, look, sorry to interrupt. Sorry to interrupt, but I've got a job. Streaming is not my full-time job, even though I'll occasionally do 5-6 hours a day. But I can't justify spending that amount of time streaming if I'm not getting donations, because I could be working, which does generate money. Now, if I lost all donations, I'd still stream 2-4 times a week maybe, but no way could I justify twice a day, because you know, I want to marry her. I want to have a family with her. I need to buy a house. Luckily, that's another reason I moved out here. I can actually buy land and build a house on my income. There's no chance of that in England. None. But, you know, I couldn't justify sacrificing that amount of time unless I was getting donations. I think you're muted, mate.
Yeah, sorry. I would like to get back to a position where I'm making a living salary from this, like a living wage, because that was the case in like 2017 and 18. 2017 and 16. But yeah, that would be the ideal, because, you know, I don't really think there is much I can do in Britain.
And it doesn't actually take a lot. If you've got 200 people watching you and they all gave 50 pence, you know, if you're streaming 5 times a week, you're done. You know, is it a British thing? I think there's a lot of working class thing, but I certainly think it's money shaming. It's grift shaming. And it's certainly damaged the British right. It has.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it creates this bad atmosphere, this resentful atmosphere where people get judged for wanting to live off doing this kind of thing. Content creation, with some people you'd say political activism. Well, okay, do you want them doing it on the weekends? Do you want them doing it in the evenings when they're tired? They're going to do a full-time job as well. Then they're not going to do as much of it. And they're not going to be as engaged. And they're not going to be as, busy. Yeah, that's the trade-off. and you can do it, but it's a different thing. But then there are people who are in a position like me where you're too notorious. You're not going to get a job, certainly not with that uses the skills that you have. I mean, I have quite a range of skills, but I would never be able to make a career in using them now.
And that, so, yeah, how incredible is that? And you sacrificed that because you wanted to make a difference. And yeah, I don't know.
I'll tell you, at the time, I just want to be honest about that. At the time I started the channel, I didn't think I would make a difference. That wasn't the reason I did it. It was, I was in such a low place that I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. I didn't realize that I actually did have a lot to lose.
Sorry.
I know, it's kind of funny, but
actually I'm fucked.
Yeah, there is this, and in a sense I there is that, there is some wondering, what if I just not gone down this route, but it's done. I can't undo it. But yeah, there's I forgot where I was. Oh yeah, so I didn't start, it wasn't intended this way. I started the channel for very, and I didn't even think about making money from it. I mean, that was a few months in when someone suggested it. At the start, it was, I just want a YouTube channel. I just want to talk to people. That was how it started. I just assumed that it wouldn't go anywhere. And I really did assume that. I thought this will just be something I do for a couple of months and, but there we are.
It's interesting though, and again, it's a real shame that YouTube done what it's done, because I set up a YouTube channel because I'd done stand up for 10 years. My Edinburgh shows sold out every year, queues round the block, and I had comedy agents saying to me, "You're one of the best stand ups in England, but you ain't going anywhere because the climate at the moment, no one's putting you on a panel show," and that's who people are signing. Stand up in England now isn't a thing of its own. It's a means to doing something else, like panel shows, presenting, etc. And so I just thought, I'm putting so much effort into this. Fuck it, I'll tell stories on the internet. And now my journey, is actually beautiful, because what my streams are now is a community. I'll get 200 people every stream. Most of them know each other. We talk about generating revenue streams. I talk a lot about presenting yourself well and clothing and things like that. And I never set that up. That wasn't the plan. It's been quite organic. And what a wonderful journey. What a wonderful thing to have. I love it. And it's a privilege. It's a privilege to know that I can set up a stream and know that I'll get at least 100 people.
Mm.
That's a really nice position to be in.
Yeah. I should say I've got a similar thing going on Telegram, not throughout Millennial, but throughout the year. I do a stream every Monday night at 10 p.m. GMT, and that goes on to Odyssey as a video called a Gram of Woes. And that gets about 100 people now. It started, I think the first time it was like 20, 25 people. I can't remember now. And that started in April, and now it's grown consistently, and it's still nowhere near YouTube numbers, but it does well. It's a nice thing. It's a very close-knit thing. We community.
Yeah, I shield a Gram of Woes the other day on my channel. Some of the things that have happened on my channel, we've got, I think, I haven't kept count, but it's got to be now 30, 40. We got about 30 or 40 people off of drink and or drugs. People have actually had dramatic life-changing things because they write, this isn't me assuming, and this isn't down to me, this is down to the community. They'll email me, and we had one just yesterday. I'm now a year clean, and I wouldn't have been able to do it without you and the scrubs. And these numbers are what an amazing thing. I'm very proud to be part of that.
Yeah, that is great. That's a wonderful achievement. Yeah, that's great. I mean, because you know, some people say that it doesn't lead to anything. It's just an echo chamber and whatever, and social media is kind of toxic. But it doesn't have to be. This is the thing. It doesn't have to be shitty. And mostly that it relies on the person who's, you know, like you, me, whatever, the content creator. But it also relies on pruning out the shitheads in the comments, getting rid of the troublemakers. And then you can have a nice community. But it is a lot of work. Getting rid of the troublemakers alone is quite a lot of work. Because well, I think weirdly, people are live on the internet thinking that they're going to just fuck things up. So you've got to get rid of them.
Well, when I released a video, "This is not a nationalist channel," thankfully, I lost most of the troublemakers because they didn't like me being part of that. That's where all my trouble come from. And I've never bitten, but the nonsense I put up with from people who are meant to be my people was just insanity.
Yeah. And
you've been through that as well. Yeah. You know, it was ridiculous, you know. But I also had a lot of support on The Offensive and Dan. They streamed with me, you know, with the Three Stooges, which was a very, you know, 900,000 viewers sometimes. A lot of other people supported me. But, you know, the people were like, how did he ever end up in our circles? Oh, it's our circles, is it now? How? What a peculiar way of looking at it.
I saw someone saying, you know, when the false allegations about me went around, there was someone saying he obviously has no place in this movement. And I thought, are you fucking joking? I was fucking here before any of you were here. Are you? It was amazing. But yeah, there is this, again, there's a certain nastiness to, I don't want to say nationalism in Britain, but it does attract a certain contingent of people who are clearly just antisocial. I mean, they're clearly just misfits, troublemakers. And, you know, some of them no doubt are feds. You know, some of them no doubt are just, you know, from MI5 or whatever, and they're there to fuck things up. But I think a lot of them are just antisocial people, and that is a fact. I mean, I don't want to shit on nationalism or that. I'm just saying this is a thing.
And the majority of the people that gave me grief, they didn't do anything. As far as I could work out, all they done was that. You know, they haven't got channels. They don't. I don't know what they. They just don't like me. Okay. You've made your point.
Yeah, exactly. Now can you piss off and just leave us alone? We're just having a community here. We're just having content creation, sharing ideas. Can you just fuck off? And of course they don't want to. That's the thing. They want to stick around and keep putting in bitchy comments. That, you know, I've got a reputation for being quite ruthless with the banhammer, but it's because, you know, my experience has taught me if you give them a second chance, they'll just say the same shit all over again.
I naively, because I'm friends with Devin Tracy, and he's got the, you know, he's very trigger happy with the banhammer. You've only got to disagree with him and you're gone. And I said to him, Devin, I'm why not that bad. Ban? No, me neither. I said, why do you ban so many people? He said, because they fuck it up. They fuck it up. And I said, I haven't banned anyone. He went, you will. I said, nah, no need. And, of course, my ban list now is about 600 strong. So, yeah.
Yeah. I should say that there are some people alluding to the false allegations last year in the chat. And, yeah, that is certain big names. Don't worry about that. That has been sorted out. It's just small people who are, I don't know how to say this without sounding condescending. It's not, no big names as far as I know are still spreading that shit. It's really just people who are not prominent in our circles who are, you know, purveying that kind of, who are still insisting on that garbage. At this point, I mean, it's amazing how that happened, but I don't want to, you know, it involves real people, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But it is amazing how that took off, and really because of just one very malicious woman. who's, well, you know her as well as you know who I'm talking about, Dangerfield. But yeah, that was, I think also I had reached a point where there were a lot of people who had it in for me and I didn't know, like people who felt that I needed brought down a peg or two. But I, you know, I don't think I did. I think it was just jealousy, frankly. But yeah, this happens. And I think it happens in any community. I think there are people who look at those who are higher up and more prominent and they just want to damage them. Yeah, it's a human thing, but it's not fucking nice.
I was talking to you just before the show. As I've already said, I was a comic and I used to, you know, my material was pretty dark. You know, that's why the agent said, you ain't going on telly. And I'd done a bit about fucking a dog. It was a bit. I was a comedian. So someone dug it out. I mean, good Lord, I wouldn't even know how to find that. And then all of a sudden it was Dangerfield fucked a dog. And I'm like, no, I told a joke. Do you not understand how comedy works?
I've got a similar thing about bestiality, right? I mentioned it in a speech in 2016 because a year earlier I had done a video about the topic saying how disturbing it is that you can't explain why it's wrong because someone, you know, there are these people, zoophiles, who whatever you say, they have an answer. They have a logical answer as to, oh, no, the animal doesn't suffer. And you know, if you wear a condom, there are no diseases. And, you know, see, you're left thinking, all right, so I can't explain why it's wrong. So, and that really scared me. It really disturbed me that you can't logically explain why bestiality is wrong. Because if you don't have a morality, and I was saying, you know, a Christian religion or whatever, people rely on logic and sophistry and whatever, just hyper rationality. So that was why I did a video about it. And then a year later mentioned it in a speech. But people take that clip from the speech and it still gets shared around now. And I still, even a few days ago on Gab, there was a guy sharing this around saying he supports bestiality. He thinks bestiality is okay. I was like, for fuck's sake. Does it seem likely? Maybe I do seem like someone who thinks bestiality is all right. I should be careful, but no, I don't. I really don't. I think it's fucking gross and very wrong.
I've had people saying that in my chat. I'll mention you, and someone will say, "No, he likes fucking animals." I'm like, and the thing is, what an interesting debate, but people shy away from those debates. You know, even on my stream, there'll be things I want to talk about. And I think, yeah, I can't. I said to you before the stream, on my channel, we do these things. We done a drawing gallery. We had a Scrubstock music festival. And one of them was old photos. And it was send in a couple of old photos of you so we can put them on the screen. All have a laugh at our 1980s step wedge and Lacoste tracksuits, blah, blah, blah. Someone said, can we send photos in as us as babies? And I said, if you want to send pictures as babies or of toddlers, no worries. But ideally, you know, teenage years, dodgy haircuts. And this bloke who knew exactly what I said, because he must have watched it, he clipped out, send me photos of you as toddlers or babies. That was all he clipped. And then the video was called something like Dangerfield is a nonce. He knows he's lying to his own audience. He knows he is because that's why he clipped that. And of course, now there's 20 people going, oh, that bloke is such a dirty pervert. Like,
yeah, we were talking about this. We were talking about this before we went on air, how annoying it is to be lied about. You know, none of us has a perfect past. There are things you could genuinely say about me that are true, that I, you know, I'm not proud of or whatever. But then there are things that people just fucking make up, and it's infuriating. But yeah, as someone said in the comments, you can't let this stuff get to you because, you know, that's what they want. You know,
The most I've ever responded is saying something like that. I've never contacted these people. You know, but what does me is they're happy to lie to their own subscribers. I mean, their subscribers might want to think about that sort of thing.
And they're happy to lie to their own subscribers just to sully someone else's name. I mean, what a rotten piece of shit that must be, who would do that.
I mean, you said most of us have done things that we regret or whatever. I mean, yeah, I've done thousands, and that you can hear me telling you on my own channel. If you really want to find out some dodgy things I've done, you can hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Yeah, I won't make the obvious joke. But anyway, on that bombshell, let's end this one because it's 4:30 in the morning here, so I should get to bed.
I just want to say thank you very much for inviting me back again for another year. Always a pleasure. I think it's something on the internet calendar that I always look forward to. I will demand an explanation if I don't get invited 1 year, of course, and that will happen. Can I share one thing?
Yeah, sure.
If you're interested in reading, I've got a Substack. If you don't know Substack, it's a really cool, it's a written word platform. It's not just fiction writing. There's also like legal teams on there who write about legal cases, all sorts of things. And there's virtually no censorship because they don't make their money through advertising, so they don't have to censor. I've got a Substack. If you go to any of my videos, you'll see the link in the description. I'll never monetize it. There's a load of stories in the archive. There's about 14 in there. The last one I put out had nearly 2,000 views in the first 12 hours. if you put your email in, every new story I write will go straight to your email. I'd appreciate that. Thank you, Woz, for letting me do that.
Oh, that's fine. I think that is the link that I gave people. Oh, no, I gave them your YouTube channel. If you give me the link for that, I'll add it to the stuff. I need to get better at that. I think next year I'll have a more sophisticated thing where it can have multiple links for each guest.
That Substack thing isn't just me for myself. It's an excellent platform. They're opposed to censorship, so I've just put that link for you in the private chat. Woz, it really worth checking out because you will find something there if you like the written word that appeals to you. And they're growing so quickly. It's amazing. I know we've got to go, but a lot of journalists who've been caught up in like The Guardian, The New York Times, et cetera, they're jumping ship because they can make more money on Substack with no sub editor saying, no, you're an activist now, not a journalist. Do what you're told. And it's a really good thing. I think it's a great response to some real problems. So, yeah, check it out.
All right. Excellent. Okay, well, let's end it there. This has actually been the longest stream so far, Dangerfield. So I didn't expect that. But we've had a good conversation. People are saying in the comments they've really enjoyed it, so that's nice. Let me just check in case there are any last-minute super chats. I don't think there are. Okay. There's this. Someone said, cozy 4 a.m. chats with Dangerfield. And then someone else said, I'm really enjoying this interview. It's great. And finally, despite there being no money in it, and despite the dissident right being ghettoized in the dark corners of the internet, it's a blessing that we can still have things like Millennial. Well, that's very kind of you to say that. Thank you. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it. And I'd like that I'm able to do this. So thank you for watching, and please spread it around. So, all right, Dangerfield, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Okay, I'll be back tomorrow night with, let me see. James Dellingpole, and then Monokulturi FM from Finland, and then Black Pigeon Speaks, and then Last Things. That's a fair mix there for four streams. I think Ryan Turnipseed as well will be in between two of those. So that's probably going to be five tomorrow night. Okay. In the meantime, Yeah, it's going to be a lot. All right. Bye-bye for now. I'll see you later.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.